It's Thursday, February the 16th, and this week on Your Breezy Breakfast, we hear about Watershed 3, an online conference about water justice. Harin Hassan from the Wellington Water Watchers gives us an overview of global water issues. Now over to our moderator, Morgan Dandy.
Good morning, Breezy Breakfast. It is Thursday, February the 16th. Today, we are getting to hear what happened at Watershed 3 over the weekend. It was the third annual presentation of a water-focused all-day seminar put on by Water Watchers. Now, I know you're used to having the host offer the territorial acknowledgement at the beginning of our meetings. I was so moved by the acknowledgement that Horeen did on Saturday that I have asked her to take care of that today. She is our guest. She is the Guelph campaign organizer for Water Watchers. So Harin Hassan, please take it away for us today.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me. I'll just jump right in. I feel like Morgan has done a good job introducing me and letting you know who I am. Today I'm joining you from the city of Guelph, which I'm assuming most of you are joining from, which is situated on the ancestral lands of the Chinantan people and the treaty lands and territories of Mississaugas of the Credit. This land is subject to Treaty 3 of 1972 and the Dish with One Spoon Covenant. And the Dish with One Spoon Covenant is a treaty between the Anishinaabe, the Mississaugas, and the Haudenosaunee that bound them together in sharing the territory and stewarding the land. As settlers, we are also incorporated into and bound by this treaty and have a responsibility to protect this land and to ensure the health and well-being of its environment. In naming whose lands we reside on, we must also reflect on the past and present injustices that Indigenous people have and continue to face across so-called Canada. As for myself, I would consider myself like not a settler because I do come from a global South country that I've immigrated from that was also impacted by colonialism. And so I'm always reminded that all people impacted by colonialism and imperialism and white supremacy must actually work together in solidarity to dismantle the systems that causes so much harm and violence. And also knowing that like our liberation is tied to one another's and by working together, it is only then that we can begin to heal our collective wounds. So essentially, that is why I am here today. And I know that this land acknowledgement is one very small step towards that collective healing. For many of you, if you are joining from different locations, or even if you are joining from Guelph, I also invite you to take a moment to check out a website called nativeland.ca to kind of learn more about whose land you might be on and reflect on the ways that you too can also be in solidarity with Indigenous people.
Thank you so much, Horeen. And it's just as impactful the second time hearing it. So what happened this weekend on Watershed? Give us a little bit of a overview of what Watershed's about, why it's important, and what the focus was for this week or for this year.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, I'll just jump right in, and then I'll also mention that in some spaces of Watershed there were consecutive workshops happening, so I wasn't in all of the spaces, so I can only speak from the parts that I witnessed and I experienced too. And then I'm also going to speak a little bit to the prompts and the thoughts that were popping up for people that ended up coming out beautifully in James Gordon's song. Okay, so I'll talk about Watershed. I'll tell you about what inspired this year's Watershed. And then I'll tell you a little bit about some of the highlights of the event and then how to continue this vital work that needs to be done around water protection and environmental justice. So as you all know, we do find ourselves in deep waters, and that was this year's theme. And the deep waters that we find ourselves in is essentially being surrounded by threats to water, to people, to planet on all sides. And we see how colonialism, capitalism, white supremacy, and patriarchy are the drivers of the crises that we've always experienced, but that like have been so intensified and we're experiencing today. So times are difficult and they're dire. And, you know, we know that they'll only get worse over time with the negative implications of climate change and the threats that we're seeing. Yet we also find ourselves surrounded with this inspiration and stories of resistance and people actually waking to the power that they have to protect the environment and each other. So there's that bit of spark of hope for at least harm reduction and reducing harm in the ways that we know we can within our spaces at least. And Watershed was about how we can navigate the deep waters that we're currently facing together and to harness our collective power and to propel the water justice movement through the deep waters that we're facing. That is kind of what inspired this year's Watershed event. We had three amazing keynote speakers. We were supposed to have Aisha Siddiqua, who's a Pakistani climate justice advocate, but due to just like, I don't know, something happened and we weren't able to get a hold of her. But we did have Serena from Six Nations, who works with Protected Tract, fill right in, and she did a beautiful, beautiful job. We also had Larissa Crawford, who is Métis and Jamaican and is a published Indigenous anti-racism and climate justice researcher, policy advisor, and restorative circle keeper. So that was very inspiring to hear from her. We also had Jasmine, who is a climate educator from the prairies, and her work centers around environmental justice and intersectional environmentalism, and especially the role of youth in decision making. She was also the executive director of the Youth Climate Lab, which was very exciting, knowing that like a young person's really driving an organization and doing really good work. So that was great. So those were our keynote speakers that were spread throughout the day. And then in between some of those sessions, we also had workshops and story sessions. So the first slot, it was we had Shahzad Khan, who is from Cologne University, talking about fresh water in Bangladesh and just like the water justice movement and what's going on in Bangladesh. And then we had Michelle Woodhouse, who was talking about Line 5 confronting an ecological disaster, and also just like what Line 5 does is it's got the potential to bring people from the Great Lakes together in working towards this resistance against the Line 5.
Some of us aren't familiar with what Line 5 is. And actually, I didn't even know what it was. So I didn't choose to go to that exact one. So if you could maybe just give us a little bit of information about what Line 5 is, so we have an understanding of why it's so important.
Okay. I will also say I was not in that workshop. So my knowledge around that is a little limited too. I was also curious about going to that one. But learning about Line 5 essentially is a 70-year-old fossil fuel energy pipeline that's running through the heart of the Great Lakes, and the Indigenous-led resistance campaign working to confront this disaster essentially is what Michelle Woodhouse was talking about. And the best part about like all these workshops, especially the consecutive ones. And you know, there were four, so you could only pick one. Once the recordings do come out, you will have the opportunity to kind of see what happened in the other spaces. So once we clean it up, edit it, and send out the recordings, like, you can learn more about that in detail. So yeah, just letting you know. And then we also had another workshop with Wee Bui from Council of Canadians talking about the threats and alternatives to water privatization. And then the last workshop of the first sessions was with Evelyn from Banking on a Better Future, essentially talking about the banks funding the destruction of our future, but mostly with the focus on RBC and the implications of the impact that we could have by divesting our money from RBC. There was also a lot of focus on Indigenous solidarity as well, as folks might know what's happening and what's sweating with the Coastal GasLink pipeline that's being fully funded by the larger banks, specifically RBC. And so, you know, where you choose to put your money is also what you choose to fund, essentially. And so we've got the power to tap into that collective action and get RBC to divest. And then the last three skills workshops we had was a space with Georgie Horton Baptiste, who talked a lot about shipbuilding, relationship building with Indigenous people. And then we had Alex, Stage Light Communications, basically talking about speaking to your audience and how you can develop meaningful messaging that brings people into your movement. And then we also had Tim and Kate from Lead Now talking about campaigns that build and defend a just, sustainable, and equitable Canada, essentially. So these were more skills building workshops that we also had throughout the day. And yeah, I feel like there were lots of moments of inspiration throughout this entire event. And depending on where folks were at in terms of their learning journey and their relationship with water, I'm sure different parts of the event resonated with different people. One fun thing that we did throughout the event was we had some listeners throughout the event that kind of, like, if something resonated with them or words that really spoke to them, they wrote it down onto a shared Google document. And then whatever those thoughts, ideas, or bits and pieces of inspiration were actually then turned into a lovely song by James Corden, which was performed at the very end of the event to close off Watershed. So it was like a very nice closing to the day. But I am going to read some of those prompts or words that came to people's mind. And I've only highlighted the few that, you know, I thought really resonated with me personally. But yeah, once the recording's out, you folks will get to witness and listen to James sing the song. Here we go. Here are some of the things that folks were listening in on and what they learned and prompts and whatnot. Deep waters aren't just dark, they're full of possibility. So the light in the dark, intertwined pathways and liberation. And then someone mentioned a quote, a podcast with Veda Austin, who is a water researcher, a public speaker, a mother, an artist. And in it, she states that water is our constant companion. From the moment we are conceived, it is with us. Even upon death, it is the water that evaporates from the physical, rising up towards the heaven. And then obviously the theme of colonialism, capitalism, white supremacy, and patriarchy, and how much they're embedded into almost every aspect of our lives, and how they've manifested in the very scary, dangerous ways that, you know, we see them moving through the world. awareness of positionality and unearned advantage. I would also mention intersectionality in that as well, because Watershed this year also really focused on intersectional issues as well, and how nothing is separate or exists alone, but the impact, you know, there's always a ripple effect of whatever is going on with the natural environment, and how that leads to further marginalization of the folks that are already vulnerable. And, you know, so all of that, everything's interconnected essentially. And then also corporate capture of water and privatization. The Line 5 issue has the potential to bring many communities of the Great Lakes together. And I feel like that is an opportunity for us. And one thing we've noticed is it's always a catastrophe or a crisis that unfortunately brings people together. But when those crises do happen, like, that is also an opportunity for people to kind of build and cultivate community and nourish it, and really like tap into that collective power. Another thing was also relationship building, and to be able to build those skills and having relationships with Indigenous folks too. I know Serena talked a lot about that, of just showing up at Lamback Lane, having meals together, even just like little things like that, of like, let's laugh together, let's get to know one another. It's like that, those micro things cultivate community. And you know, like, once you're in community with someone, you are invested in them and their issues, and you're invested in their liberation, and they're invested in yours. And so I feel like that is a very small thing that we could do to resist capitalism and colonialism by cultivating a sense of community. Kinship, the whole creation is related. And so we need to start acting like it too, because we don't currently. And that's where that division and disconnection happens, where we divide ourselves from not only each other, but also the natural environment. And there was another quote that kind of ties into that really well. The land knows you even when you are lost. And as the land becomes impoverished, so too does the scope of our vision. And I feel like that is kind of what we see happening throughout and across our world today. And that has led to a lot of environmental and ecological grief and eco-anxiety. I know for me personally, as a younger person, there is a lot of anxiety around that. Larissa Crawford talked a lot about decolonizing environmental movements. So that was a big topic, because we do see environmental movements kind of being a little whitewashed. So what does it mean to decolonize them and to indigenize those spaces, and, you know, change the approach that we currently have, and putting the communities who are on the front lines fighting for environmental protection and being stewarding the land, like, how are they being honored, and how are, you know, like, what's our role in being led by Indigenous folks and their movements and whatnot. And then the last one I'll mention is environmental movements and diversity of approaches. Visions that are decolonized hold space to acknowledge harm that was done by ancestors, action in action, and how that influenced and shaped where we are today. One thing I've been talking a lot about, because I've been, you know, I'm moved with the idea that, like, our liberation is tied to one another's, and I see that, like, amongst the Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities. But then we also see that even the past of the oppressors and you know, white folks, there's a lot of trauma of violence too. And, you know, that also needs to heal as well. And so our collective liberation is truly intertwined, and we need to be invested in one another and each other's communities. So that was just kind of my personal takeaway. I haven't had a chance to actually debrief Watershed with my team. We've had some busy days over the past week. I came out of a board meeting that ended at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock last night. Just like working on catching up. So I haven't had the chance to actually debrief with my team. So these are just like my little tidbits of what resonated with me about Watershed. I'm just going to end it off on one little thing. We know that this work needs to be done and to continue to be done, and it's vital work. And as folks, you folks are pretty engaged around budgets, municipal budgets, and I'm sure, there's a lot of anger around Doug Ford and just like what he chooses to prioritize too. And budgets are about priorities, and there's a lot of community needs and priorities that need to be met. And it's often groups such as yours or groups such as mine or any other civil society organization, like essentially working to fill the gaps that our governments don't bother to fill and whatnot. So in order to continue this work, as you might know, Water Watchers is not funded by anyone. So it's usually individual donors and donations that allow our organization to do this kind of work. And if you are someone that believes that should be a priority, I also invite you to donate to the Water Watchers, whatever you can, so that we can continue to do the work that we are passionate about. And I'll end on that note. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Horeen. So there was a couple of things that you said that I'd like to unpack just a little bit to help people understand, a little bit more. You and I have been doing this work for a while, and, we get a lot of the terms because we talk about it in some of our other work that we've done together. So one of the things that is coming up a lot more is the word intersectional or intersectionality. What is intersectionality?
So the word intersectionality, I will say, was coined by a person named Kimberly Crenshaw. And to put it simply, it's essentially looking at a situation with the multiple different lenses and perspectives, and like there's different layers at play that intersect with one another to create a situation or to impact the lived experiences of a person. So like, for example, the experiences of a Black woman will be different than those of a white woman or a Black man, for example, because there's different implications depending on a person's positionality. I'm basically saying this from like the perspective of like Kimberly Crenshaw and how like the word was coined. So like, for example, women are impacted negatively by the patriarchy, but that like a layer is added to that when you're a Black woman or when you're a woman of color. And so there's different layers depending on the identities you might carry. And so like your race intersects with your gender, and that intersection impacts how you move through the world and how the world sees you, essentially. And so that's kind of where the word came from, Kimberly Crenshaw. And we see that in many different spaces. And to connect it back to like the environmental movement, intersections exist almost everywhere, and nothing kind of exists alone. And if there's an environmental disaster, who is at the front lines and who is impacted first. Like, for example, I've been doing a lot around, or I've been having lots of conversations about Guelph specifically, and doing work around environmental justice, but also exploring intersections. And recently, a lot of conversation has been around the climate crisis and its impact on the houseless population. And it's like, the climate crisis is coming for all of us, but who's impacted first and worst? And it tends to be those who are vulnerable or marginalized in our communities, that they'll see it first, and they'll see its implications first, and they'll be hit the hardest first. And so, you know, that just kind of shows how poverty intersects with the environmental justice movement, how race in many communities, like even folks that are not unhoused but come from migrant communities, or maybe they're migrant workers here in Canada, it's like they're impacted completely differently than you and I might be. And, you know, so also, like, it's about looking at the different issues and where they intersect or might overlap, or how they intensify one another depending on what the issue is and how it interacts with another issue. It's how issues interact with one another and how they connect and how they make situations worse for people depending on positionality, location, race, many different factors.
That's great. And I think you described it wonderfully. One of the things that you've said a couple of times in that explanation is positionality. And that is something that I had never actually heard the word until Arlene started talking about it. And when she went through and explained her positionality, it was eye-opening to me. And I'm looking at going and doing some more research and figuring out what my positionality is in order to figure out how I fall within a lot of things, where my viewpoint is. Let's unpack what positionality is a little bit together, because I just went and did a quick Google search and there's a whole bunch of stuff there to look at. What's your understanding of positionality?
For me personally, positionality, kind of like what I mentioned already, of who you are in the world and what you're born with, location matters, race matters, and level of wealth and class matters, and all those things kind of position you somewhere in society. And unfortunately, with the way our society works, there's hierarchies, and, you know, some people are positioned in different places and spaces, and because of that positionality, society and the world around them is gonna interact with them differently. So, like, the world's gonna look at me differently than they would look at my coworkers, for example, and they're gonna interact with them differently than they're gonna interact with me, depending on, just like, it could be, or maybe that's not the best example because we are close in some ways, but like,
well, even let's just take you and me, Horeen. So we're different age categories.
Yes.
We were born in different countries. You know, you were born in the global south. I was born in the global north. I am white. To me, you're white presenting. And, you know, knowing that you're from the global south, that actually makes me have to change my mind about how I see you, because knowing that helps me understand you had different experiences than I did growing up. You didn't have the same opportunities necessarily as someone in the global north would, because of where you were born, that positionality of location. So, you know, it's a lot. And I think it was very complex. One of the things that Arlene stated was, you know, my positionality, she spoke about her gender, that she's a cis woman, cisgender woman with, you know, a certain age of body. And it was just really interesting. And I wanted to bring it up because it was the first time that I had heard that word. And I would love for more people to have an understanding of what positionality is, because it really does frame our ability to look at the different things around the world when it comes to environmental justice, whether it has to do with water or it has to do with one of the other many things that go into your positionality, which works with intersectionality as well. There was a quick question. You mentioned about the whitewashing of, you know, the climate movement. Can you expand a little bit on what's meant by the whitewashing of the environment movement?
For me personally, and like how I see that is also just kind of where who's in a position of power to also, I didn't get a full glimpse of what Larissa Crawford talked about, but from what I know of the environmental justice movement, sometimes is that those that are in positions of power or have funding and the ability to do this work in like in an organizational way or actually be paid to do that kind of work do tend to be like wider environmental organizations, whereas you do see communities who are at the front lines fighting for environmental justice and land protections and whatnot that might not have the same opportunities to do that same similar type of work, or maybe even might not have the educational background that you do, didn't go to university. But does that make like whatever expertise they have that they've gained from their communities and knowledge holders and whatnot, like how do you compare that to someone who's got like a degree in environmental science and like a master's in like water, you know? So it's like, it's also about the colonial views of like whose expertise we uphold and don't, and who we invite into our spaces to hear from and pay, and who we don't. And so a lot of the times those who are interacting with the negative implications of the climate crisis tend to be racialized communities, indigenous communities. And they're the ones on the front line doing that stewardship work and whatnot. So there's like many ways in which sometimes environmental movements seem a little removed from you know, the intersections, you know, like there is no, like, I like to say this all the time, there's no climate justice without land back and indigenous sovereignty. You can't fight for one without fighting for the other, because that is, you know, those folks have been the stewards of the natural environment. And, you know, capitalism's fairly new. Like, the planet existed a lot longer than when settlers came to Turtle Island. And so just in a short amount of time, like what colonization has done and the displacement and the destruction to the natural environment. And I feel like that should say everything, because colonialism is truly embedded in a lot of like what we see as legitimate and what we put value on. But like, I also see that changing, where we're shifting our movements and where we're changing the way that our organizations function. And we know that they're inherently colonial, but like, we're working to undo that and to decolonize our spaces. And sometimes that word is used as like a buzzword. They'll put it in front of anything as if it's like, you know, and sometimes I'm like, how can organizations that are colonial in nature and were created in such a way actually decolonize? So like, you know, that's also something, a word that I struggle to fully understand, of like how you actually do decolonize spaces, especially when you might be a settler working for a settler organization that only had settlers in mind. So what does decolonizing our spaces look like is still something I'm exploring and learning more about.
And I know one of the things that will help us in decolonizing is understanding more about corporate capture. One of the things that sort of struck me as being an intersectional point is the work that Decolonial Solidarity does for Wet Sweatin as far as RBC goes. And there was a component of Watershed that was talking about banking. So let's get a little bit into what that's all about and why RBC specifically.
RBC specifically because they are the largest funder of the pipeline, the Coastal GasLink pipeline. And the thing about that specific campaign is it's completely decentralized. There's RBCs in every corner, and that also gives us this great opportunity to kind of tap into that collective action, where you can start up anywhere with anyone and do whatever is within your capacity to do. Like, if you only want to tweet at RBC, go ahead, because that is still something. If you want to go have a meeting with a branch manager to be like, hey, I don't like that you are funding this pipeline that, to be honest, isn't even profitable. Like, at this point, it's like you're destroying the planet and, you know, violating Indigenous people's rights for a pipeline that's not going to do you any good either. Or if you want to write a letter, or if you bank with RBC, taking your money out, having like little things that you could do that are tangible, that like if all of us do it, we'll definitely have a dent and an impact on RBC specifically, because RBC has a reputation to uphold, and the reputational risk is worse for them than the financial risk in terms of like with the pipeline and funding it. So I feel like that's something that they're protective over. So we can do a lot of reputational damage by tapping into our collective networks and, like, you know, encouraging folks to divest their money and letting them know why that money is being divested. I don't know if I answered your question.
No, you did. You know, we've done some work with the Decolonial Solidarity group, and one of the things that, because you're so used to it that you forgot to mention, is that yes, it is decentralized. There are RBCs all over Canada, and the individuals that are working in all of the decentralized locations are following the lead of the Indigenous leaders.
Yes.
I think that's the one most important fact, that because we've been doing the work, that we kind of forget to express that this isn't a bunch of people just getting together because they don't like what RBC is doing. This has to do with the fact that there are land defenders and water defenders out in BC of Wet Sweatin, in the Wet Sweatin territories, where they're being forced off their land. The pristine waters are being threatened by this work that isn't even going to be profitable within the lifetime of anyone. Even somebody born today, the pipeline's not going to be profitable. It's going to be at least 100 years before it's profitable. So all of the work that the Decolonial Solidarity groups do is at the request and with the guidance of the Indigenous that we are all seeking to bring more awareness to.
Yes, that is very true. Decolonial Solidarity is a settler organization, and there's a whole toolkit on what has been requested by the hereditary chiefs and like what their guidance is. And basically, it is a group that is self-organized so that the labor is on the settler folks to be responsive to the needs of folks at Gedimden Checkpoint and Wet'suwet'en and the hereditary chiefs and their needs, and kind of responding to it and taking their lead rather than, you know, exactly what Morgan mentioned. Because labor does need to be distributed, and taking it upon settler communities to show up in that way and be responsive to the needs of the Indigenous folks and land defenders and in whatever capacity we can be is also really, really neat to see, because I think it's the first time for me personally I'm seeing a settler organization show up in that way, and it's amazing.
Yeah, it is really amazing. I was just going over to try and find the Facebook link. So if anybody would like to get involved with Decolonial Solidarity Guelph, there is a Facebook group. If you just Google it, it'll come up. We'd love to have more people involved in, you know, protecting the water, because regardless of where the water is, all water is connected. One of the things that I sat in on was with V. Boo from the Council of Canadians. How was Council of Canadians involved with the Watershed 3, and what kind of relationship does Water Watchers have with Council of Canadians? What's their role?
We do have a close relationship with Council of Canadians because there are a lot of intersectional or a lot of issues and similarities and interests in terms of values, where there's opportunities that, you know, we do end up at the same tables sometimes.
I actually sat in on that, and there was a lot, you know, we started off talking about corporate capture, and they just asked the question, what is corporate capture to the people in the group? So to me, when I hear about corporate capture, what I think about is oppression. Basically, it's all the extractive practices and the fact that now we're seeing this horrendous shift from governments being the rulers to corporations telling governments what needs to happen. And it's another layer of the colonial capitalist society where it's everything's about what's good for the corporation, and what's good for the people is not really thought about anymore. So what are some of the things that Water Watchers has coming up in the next little while that we might be able to get involved in?
So we do have our Water Watchers Award tonight coming up, and it'll be around like World Water Day. So that is something to look forward to. The environmental justice campaigns also another thing to look forward to. We're currently in the exploratory process of it all. I know I talked about it briefly around just like me exploring the issues within Guelph and how the issue of the housing crisis and homelessness intersects and poverty intersects with the environmental justice movement and its implications, and also just like where there's opportunities for Guelph to show up in like a very communal, collective, mutual aid network kind of a way to, you know, do some of that climate change mitigation, like, or like harm reduction planning, because we know these things are happening. How are we showing up for those that are on the receiving end of some of the negative implications of climate change? And then also, you know, I can't say too much about this at the moment, but We're working on a blue triton campaign. A lot of you folks, if you've known the Water Watchers, you know it has always been organizing around Nestle. And so now that Nestle has been bought out by an equity firm called Blue Triton, it almost kind of seems as if like no one really sees Blue Triton as much of a threat as they saw Nestle as. And so trying to revive that campaign in a way is also something that we are currently in the process of. So it's something from, you know, the work that I personally am doing within the organization that you can look forward to.
So as far as the work with Blue Triton, you and I have both been involved in a lot of the protests that have happened down there when the water defenders from Six Nations issued cease and desist letters that the corporations have not even really acknowledged, as far as I can see. What are we looking at doing for the next little bit as far as all of those lovely trucks that we get to stand in front of and stop going into the plant?
Yeah, so like I said, I can't say too much right now, but there is something in the works with Six Nations. So there might be an opportunity for folks to show up in a big way and to show that solidarity, especially given that, you know, Six Nations is located so close to us. It's an opportunity for us to really show that solidarity work. Stay tuned is all I can say right now.
Absolutely. I know some of the other work that Water Watchers does, and you did mention it, has to do with land back. What's been sort of the Water Watchers and the 1492 land back relationship?
So that relationship began because of the pandemic. I can't even keep track of like how many years it's been. I believe it was summer of 2020, 2021 when the Unity Jams were happening. And so that is how, for me personally, I got involved, was me just kind of showing up with labor folks because they had cultivated a relationship with folks at 1492 Landback Lane. So I'd join them to get to know some of the folks at Six Nations and get to know like what they cared about, and also just like investing in just being human together. And that's how our relationship was formed. And then I started volunteering at the Unity Jams and met more people. Arlene would come with me, and we rented out a water truck for one of the Unity Jams as well, so that folks, it was a hot summer day and we gave out water bottles as well. So it was a good time, and that relationship kind of formed over that summer. And then it went further with like opportunities for us to give folks space in some of our workshops or in our watershed events. I know there was one watershed, it was in October, I believe. So there were a lot of Six Nations folks at that event as like keynote speakers and whatnot. And so that then led the relationship further, where there were opportunities for us to work together in certain ways. But like from that, what has happened was like some really nice friendships have formed that then translate into actual work on the ground that we could do together.
That's one of the places where I got to know you a little bit better. And it's again, going back to that intersectionality of knowing where to go to do the things that you want to do that make your heart feel good. And helping people in whatever ways we can. And that's what a lot of people here really want to do, is figure out ways to help. And I see that, Gordon, you've just unmuted yourself. Did you have a comment that you'd like to add in?
Yeah, I like where you were going with that, of people getting together and doing things together. And I don't care what color they are. And if you really want to turn me off, the first thing you'll tell me is what color you are, or what religion you are, or whatever it is, and then repeat that time after time after time. And I don't care. You're a person, I'm a person. We get together, we have share values, we develop a vision of the future that we're working towards. And that's the most important thing. So I don't like putting emphasis on color in any of this kind of work, because I think it detracts from.
Okay. And I can see where, as an individual that has a lot of unearned, what's the word I'm looking for, instead of privilege?
Yeah, unearned. I agree with you.
And this is a serious conversation that needs to happen.
Yep.
When someone that is coming from a viewpoint of whiteness, and that's you and me, Gordon, when we say that we either don't see color or we don't want to see color, that is actually a white supremacist phrase. Whether we like it or not, I have used the term colorblind, and I was totally schooled by a program that I watched yesterday where I found out that that is actually a very white supremacist statement. The reason that anyone that is white has the ability to say that they're colorblind is because they have never had to deal with the things that Black, Indigenous, and racialized people have had to deal with. We can't even imagine what's been going through. And that's a big part of water justice. It is the Global South and the marginalized, the racialized communities that have the most issues with water. And that's why intersectionality and positionality that we were talking about earlier, unpack the definition a little bit. And these conversations between us white folks really need to happen. And honestly, from what I have learned over the last couple of days, me as a liberal white woman, it's my responsibility. And that's why I'm calling out what I am hearing today, because as a liberal white woman, it is my responsibility to call it out if my goal is to work with people so we do have equality and equity.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all. I've, there's no question. Background and all that stuff, you've born into an advantageous position. Most of the discussions I have with people, I end up saying, well, capitalism is the issue.
Maureen, I'd like to ask you, as a racialized individual born in the Global South, you know, when you hear people use phrases like, oh, well, I don't see color, or I'm colorblind, how does that, like, from my understanding, that's more than just a microaggression. How does that make someone that is Black, Indigenous, or racialized feel? What's your experience been with that?
If you interpreted what I said as that I think I'm colorblind, I don't accept that.
No, but you. So I just want to get Horeen's sort of viewpoint on the two phrases. You know, I don't see color, or I don't care about color, and colorblindness. They're all intertwined. So.
But not the same thing.
And you know what, Gordon, that's not up to you and me to make a definition about. That is up to the Black, racialized, and Indigenous people that have been affected by these things.
Going back to what I feel like we've been talking about for the past hour, of just like intersectionality and how the world will interact with you depending on so many different factors, and even like between maybe you and I, Morgan, someone might receive you differently than how they might interact with me as like a younger person. Or, you know, I am a little white passing. Like, some people can identify that I'm not from the Western world, sometimes like with my friends, I can see even the way that they interact with my friends in comparison to me and my darker skinned friends. Like, it's going to change depending on who's interacting with who, and how the world perceives us and receives us differently, and then the unearned advantages of being white, and how there's fewer barriers, or even like, for example, if you were applying for a job, there have been many times where folks from the BIPOC community, like, they're told, oh, you should change your name, because if they see a name that doesn't sound white, like, they're gonna toss your resume out. Or even just like little things like that, of like, because of who you are, your identity, the way that settler organizations and institutions are going to interact with you is going to be very different. I can't turn off my color when I go to the grocery store. I'm still a brown woman when I go to the grocery store. My mom wearing a hijab is going to be treated differently because of her religion. People will know what her religion is, and they will interact with her differently because they see a hijab. You, like, although you can say, I don't see color, I don't see religion. Yeah, you do. Everyone else sees it, and they're interacting with me differently because they see it, and it's there, and it's also a part of me. It's a part of my identity. To not be seen for who I am is, you know, so it just goes to show that I don't want to see it, and I don't see it, so I'm not going to interact with those things. And so it almost, like, I feel another thing that Water Watchers did very recently was the Dew Retreat, and it was a space that Arlene created where settler folks could actually come together and do the work, because there's resources out there, there's workshops out there, there's so many books, there's documentaries, there's a lot of insight, you know. It's like, without putting the burden and the labor onto Indigenous folks, like, and racialized folks, but like doing your own work in terms of like, okay, a community says this isn't about my opinion versus their opinion. It's about what a community has said is harmful, or harmful behavior, or harmful language. It's then up to us to take that and figure out how we're going to change, and how we're going to make folks feel included and safe enough to exist the way that they need to exist without, you know, all the barriers that they do have to engage with, and hurdles that they have to pass in order to catch up. And even just the way that you responded, Morgan, was an example of what needs to be done, rather than, you know, a Black, Indigenous, racialized people always being put in a position to be like, here, like, you know, respond to this racist thing that someone might have said that is harmful and has that line of thinking.
Maureen, I thank you so very much for making yourself vulnerable like that. I, as you were speaking, I recognized that even just asking you to weigh in on that could be perceived as an aggression by you. And if it was, I apologize.
Not an aggression at all. I'm just pointing to ways that we can kind of take it upon ourselves to do the education, because there's just so much out there. There's so many workshops. There's so many opportunities to learn. And yeah.
And I see that Councillor Erin Caton is with us today with their hand up. Erin, what would you like to contribute to the conversation?
I was just thinking, because it's Black History Month, there is a program that goes on through the Guelph Black Heritage Society, and it's called Mind Your Mind, Relearn, Reprogram, Relief. And it's currently underway. It's from January 14th to April 1st, but that might be something that folks are interested in looking into potentially for the next one, because they do have a lot of good programs talking about this sort of thing.
I'm encouraging everyone on CBC Gem. You can go online and just Google a movie. It's called Deconstructing Karen. It was an incredible look into why these conversations are necessary and a big part of why I was able to say what I did.
Thanks for raising that, for getting that conversation going. It was valuable. And if you're looking for a good book, this one is just arrived in the library 2 days ago. It's got six Indigenous authors wrote it. And it's The End of This World, Climate Justice in So-Called Canada. And it talks about a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about here. And they're all very well respected researchers and authors, and for some of we white folks, it's a difficult read.
And you know what? We need to get comfortable with being uncomfortable, Gordon. That's one of the things that all of the work with environmental justice, if you're not a little bit uncomfortable, maybe you're not doing the work that you really want to be doing. We started off talking about watershed. We finished off with a little bit more understanding of what intersectionality and positionality is and how water justice fits into our lives. Maureen, thank you so very, very much for being with us today.
Yeah, I just want to express my gratitude for the invitation for me to be here. Thank you so much for also being invested in this work. I know that, you know, Morgan, you always show up to Water Watchers events. You always participate, and as do so many of you in the space. And you know, it's it feels nice to know that the community's behind you when you're doing that kind of important work. And yeah, just extending an invitation to folks to, like, if these issues are a priority to you, we'd love to have the funding to be able to continue to do that work, because it's needed. So I invite you to make a donation. And yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Horeen. And for the listening audience, if you want to find out more about Water Watchers, you can do a search, Wellington Water Watchers, and that will get you to their webpage. Again, Horeen, thank you so much. Thank you for the conversation. And I'm turning it over to Tanya for announcements. Take it away.
Hi there. We've got the Welcome Back Doug Ford Rally. Where is it? Queen's Park. It's on Saturday, February the 25th. A bus will be leaving from Guelph early in the morning on Saturday. Please contact Guelph District Health Coalition at gmail.com to RSVP to get on that bus. The Guelph Coalition for Active Transportation is having their annual general meeting February 22nd at 6:30 p.m. It's at the expanded Royal City Brewery, 199 Victoria Road at York Road. There are great door prizes and there will be free appies. The guest speaker is the executive director of the Guelph to Goderich Rail Trail. The Ontario Health Coalition is having an online town hall on Wednesday, February 22nd at 6:30. To register, Google Ontario Health Coalition Guelph Town Hall. Justice for Workers is having a Medicare meltdown meeting. What is this meeting? It's about the underfunding and privatization of our medical system. It's happening on Sunday, February 26th from 3 to 4:30 p.m. at 42 Carden Street in the community classroom. Please email guelph@justiceforworkers.org. There is the Highway Planning Webinar Series. It started on February the 9th and it goes until May the 4th. Breezy Breakfasters get a 10% discount using the code G as in good, B as in breezy, B as in breakfast 44. Please go to transportfutures.ca/highway. The North End Harvest Market Quarter Auction Fundraiser will be on Saturday, March the 18th at Trinity United Church, 400 Stevenson Street. Doors open at 1, auction begins at 2. $5 for the first bidding paddle and $4 for additional bidding paddles. For more information, please contact Barb at 519-835-1016. Next week on Breezy Breakfast, we're talking community engagement with Glenn Lombard, who is the manager of community engagement at the City of Guelph, and Tracy Surick, the community engagement coordinator.
Thank you so much, Tanya, for all of those announcements. Looking forward to next week, finding out more about how our city is communicating with us.
Thanks for tuning in. Music was provided by Jules Germ. Podcast production was provided by me, Longfi Chen. Thanks for listening and see you next week.